I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Attorney General Eric Holder spoke at the annual meeting of the American Bar Association on Monday and announced a change in the country's war on drugs. He outlined a directive to reduce the harsh sentences for nonviolent drug-related crimes, saying, "Too many Americans go to too many prisons for too long for no good law enforcement reasons." He was talking about the mandatory minimum sentences and other harsh penalties that became the law in the 1980s. That led to a dramatic increase in the prison population. Today, there are 219,000 inmates in federal prison, and half of them are there for drug offenses. Drug laws have had a disproportionately negative effect on poor African American and Hispanic men. Our guest Eric Sterling helped to write those laws when he was counsel to the U.S. House Judiciary Committee from 1979 to 1989. He is now the president of the Criminal Justice Policy Center in Silver Spring, Maryland, joining us from NPR in Washington. And Eric Sterling, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. It's a pleasure to be here.
What's the significance of Eric Holder's announcement on Monday?
It's extremely significant because no attorney general has so strongly criticized the criminal justice system in this way and called so strongly for reforms in the way in which the Department of Justice selects cases and seeks sentences in drug cases and other matters.
What's interesting is, and it's only been a couple of days since that announcement, is that we haven't heard a dramatic pushback from his announcement. What do you make of that?
That's a good question. I was reading the announcement from the National District Attorneys Association, which was critical, that suggested that the Attorney General was relying on myths and that his calls were reckless. I think there will be pushback from those who see the advantage in a trial to have mandatory minimums as a way to coerce people to plead guilty and to force them to cooperate in testifying against others.
I guess what I was reading, there's an organization, Right on Crime. It's headed up actually by Grover Norquist, among other conservative leaders, and they seem to embrace this idea.
Well, actually, Right on Crime has been saying these kinds of things, and I think they are embracing this. Many conservatives, many Republicans have been very alarmed by the increase in the prison system, by the long sentences. They see how tremendously expensive it is. They are opposed to the wasteful punishment as any kind of waste in government. And they are there's, in fact, an effort in the Congress that's being led by very conservative Republican James Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin to have a task force on over-criminalization. It's a bipartisan effort that is, I think, in sync with the sentiments of the Attorney General.
And do you think this is largely about money because it's so expensive to incarcerate people and we have so many people in prison now?
Certainly, money is a very big piece of this. The federal appropriation for next year, the Attorney General asked for over $8 billion to operate the prisons. And in April, the Department of Justice asked for $236 million in new construction for prisons. So people are very aware that in a time of very limited resources, if these are not well spent, this is a very serious problem. But it also goes to broader questions of justice. Republicans and Democrats, I think, are generally united in their desire for justice. There may be different kinds of crimes that they think ought to be prosecuted, but the underlying principles of how a criminal justice system ought to operate are shared. At the two hearings of the Task Force on Overcriminalization, Republicans and Democrats were equal in talking about the problem of the way in which crimes are defined in their overbreadth, in the lack of specificity, in the lack of specificity of the conduct, or the mental states that required to prove an offense has been committed.
What's interesting, and you were a part of this, is the creation of these mandatory minimum sentences, the tough on crime laws that came out of, I guess, the 70s and the 80s. Much of this tied to the crack epidemic and the crime wave associated with that crack epidemic of that time. Since you were a counsel to the U.S. House Judiciary Committee during this time, can you describe, I guess, what the mood of the country was at that time?
Yes, the 70s were not a time when there was a lot of anti-crime legislation being written. I mean, at the very beginning under Nixon, that was the case, but it was less so under Ford and Carter. There was a big shift when President Reagan was inaugurated in 1981. Crime rates had sort of peaked at that point, and while they were actually beginning to drift down, news media was paying a lot of attention to crime, and even though absolute numbers and rates of use of marijuana and cocaine were beginning to decline at that point, these were still at what were seen as historically high levels. In 1984, the president offered a large crime package that defeated the Democrats politically. It passed in October. It was a part of the Reagan reelection effort. And Democrats, in part, were smarting politically from that defeat. As the emphasis on marijuana enforcement took place, Colombians shifted to exporting cocaine. Cocaine supplies were becoming more plentiful, and cocaine was then being converted into crack beginning in about 84, 85. And so by the summer of 86 was sort of the summer of crack cocaine in mid-East cities where, you know, the people's sleep was disturbed by the sound of car alarms going off because people addicted to crack and cocaine would break into a car to steal the radio to sell for $5 and a couple of doses of cocaine.
Do you think racial fears were also part of what was going on in the country at that time?
Yes, there certainly were racial fears. Unemployment had grown in the African-American communities with the Reagan recession of the early 80s. There was a lot of joblessness. And there was a way in which you could, I think, blame a variety of social ills not on the failure to fund schools or the failure to sort of build the economy, provide entrepreneurial opportunities and employment, to blame it on the drug problem. And there was an element of that. Crack in particular acquired a racial dimension that the data never supported. The nightly news, if they wanted to show the crack epidemic, would go into an inner city neighborhood. They would spot people sitting on stoops smoking crack pipes. They wouldn't go to white neighborhoods. They wouldn't see the same kind of thing, even though always the overwhelming majority of crack users were white. And that's still the case in the United States.
And part of this evolution of these drug wars was the tragic death of Len Bias, a gifted basketball player, died of a drug overdose. I guess it was a seizure produced by using cocaine. And his tragic death was the impetus for some of these harsh penalties, including mandatory minimum sentences.
Marty, you're right. In the spring of 86, there had been bills introduced to especially punish crack dealers. There was a major debate over gun control in the spring of 86 that I was involved in which the NRA got a lot of what they had hoped for in changing the federal gun laws. And when Len Bias died, it is hard, if you're not in Washington, to appreciate how much Washingtonians knew who he was. He was a local high school kid. He'd gone to the University of Maryland. So if you watch the nightly news in Washington, you knew who this kid was. You had seen him on the sports highlights dozens and dozens of times. You have to remember that, you know, every member of Congress, every night that they're in Washington, is watching the nightly news before they go to bed. And here they see Len Bias. You know, they know who he is. Congressmen are very interested in sports like baseball. They like to talk about sports. They have a basketball court in the House gym. You know, there's a basketball hoop, you know, in every garage or in every driveway. And so this is a sport they're keenly attentive to. Bias was the rival of Michael Jordan. He was a superstar. He was extraordinarily gifted. And Maryland won the NIT championship, and he was drafted by the NBA champions, the Celtics. The Celtics had won the NBA championship. They were, you know, a powerhouse. And when he signs with them in the Boston Garden, it's a front-page story. This is big news. This kid signs a multi-million-dollar Reebok contract. So the morning paper is reporting the signing while the morning TV shows and radio shows are saying he's dead in Prince George's Hospital. This was a shock. This was an enormous shock.
And what is so extraordinary, and you were helping to draft some of these laws, and I think because Congress gets so little done these days, it seems that within about 3 or 4 days or perhaps a week's worth of time, these laws were signed and going into effect. You have also described there were no hearings. It was just kind of ramrodded through these.
It wasn't quite as fast as you described, you know, but it was extraordinarily fast. When the members of Congress came back from the July 4th recess, you know, they all were coming back with constituents talking about this cocaine-related death of Bias. Don Rogers, who'd been the NFL Rookie of the Year at the Cleveland Browns, he died a few days after Len Bias from cocaine. So there was a tremendous sense, oh my God, this is an extraordinarily powerful drug killing these extraordinarily fit young men. And the Speaker called the Democratic Steering and Policy Committee together and said, I want every committee to have a piece of a drug bill. And we began then about 4 weeks of assembling drug bills. There were many, many hearings on many, many issues. I'd been working on money laundering and designer drugs, and those were folded into the bill. Foreign Affairs brought in a thing to certify foreign countries. You had the Armed Services Committee. You know, the Ways and Means Committee had something for the Customs Service. The Agriculture Committee had something for the National Forests and Marijuana. Interior had the National Parks. Every committee was involved. And in the last week before the recess, the Republicans on the Crime Subcommittee were able to get two of the Democrats to agree that there had to be a crackdown piece of increased sentencing. And so this is being developed on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, with no hearings.
And hold on to that thought, because we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. That's Eric Sterling. He's now the president of the Criminal Justice Policy Center in Silver Spring, Maryland. And back from 79 to 89, he was counsel to the U.S. House Judiciary Committee. And we're talking about how mandatory minimum sentences came to be. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing Education at PAFA invites you to join their community of artists of all ages and levels of experience this fall, featuring classes in drawing, painting, sculpture, and printmaking, pre-college Saturday classes for high school students, and weekend master workshops with renowned artists, including Vincent Desiderio and Elizabeth Osborne. Registration is now open. Details online at pafa.edu/CE.
The WHYY Connections Festival is back with a day of free live music featuring They Might Be Giants, Ben Queller, and more. Saturday, September 7th at the Great Plaza at Penn's Landing. The WHYY Connections Festival is free for everyone, and WHYY members and sustainers get exclusive access to the member Oasis tent all day long. They Might Be Giants and more Saturday, September 7th at the Great Plaza. For a full lineup and to register, visit whyy.org/connectionsfestival.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, Middle East peace talks are supposed to begin in Jerusalem, but there are protests against Israel's release of Palestinian prisoners and its plan for more settlement construction. Secretary of State John Kerry says the issues underscore the need to get to the negotiating table as soon as possible. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Eric Sterling. He's the president of the nonprofit Criminal Justice Policy Foundation in Silver Spring, Maryland. We've been talking about the history of mandatory minimum sentences that became law in the 1980s and have led to a dramatic increase in the prison population, something that Attorney General Eric Holder talked about at his speech at the American Bar Association on Monday in San Francisco. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. But it sounds like, Eric, as you described, that both the Democrats and the Republicans wanting to respond to these drug deaths and also this cocaine epidemic were trying to out-tough each other when it came to getting tough on crime.
That's exactly right. It was the Republicans saw, of course, what the Democrats were trying to do. And so, an example was the sentences that the House proposed, a minimum of 5 years with a maximum of 20, in the Republican Senate became a minimum of 5 with a maximum of 40. Our highest sentences, which was a minimum of 10 with a maximum of 40, in the Republican Senate became a minimum of 10 with a maximum of life. You have to remember that before 1986, 15 years was the maximum for being a drug trafficker.
Wow.
The other thing that happened is that the quantities that triggered these maximums were these minimums and maximums were very, very small and got smaller. So that when we enacted a 5-gram crack cocaine mandatory at 5 years, up to 40 years. 5 grams is like 1 gram is a sweet and low packet. Now, a ton of cocaine is 1 million grams. So when you hear about a ship being seized in the Gulf of Mexico with 4 tons, you're talking about 4 million grams. Huh. These 5 grams, these 50 grams that triggered the 10 years, or even 5 kilos of powder cocaine that was the high end that triggered a mandatory 10 years for cocaine trafficking, these are tiny quantities in the national cocaine market. And so the Justice Department overwhelmingly focused on these low-level offenders. And this is a large part of what Eric Holder was talking about, because when you look at the data on who the Justice Department has been prosecuting, overwhelmingly it's been low-level offenders.
But
the average weight of all the federal crack cases was most recently 51 grams.
But was the original intention, and going back to the creation of these laws, was to go after these low-level drug dealers, or was it to go after the drug kingpins?
It was to go after the kingpins. The whole rationale for these new heightened sentences was to create an incentive for the Justice Department to focus on high-level offenders. The mistake that we made in our haste was to pick quantity levels that did not indicate the high-level people we had in mind. Remember, members of Congress don't speak metric. You know, most members of Congress couldn't tell you whether a milligram is more or less than a kilogram. You know, these numbers, nobody sat down and said, do these numbers make sense? Because the original proposal that I brought to the subcommittee to talk about hundreds of thousands of doses per month over a period of 6 months, which was what the DEA used themselves to define high-level traffickers, that was rejected. Congressman Mazzoli from Louisville, Kentucky said, we don't have drug dealers that big at Louisville. Hmm. And nobody said, hey, Ron, nobody goes to Louisville to do a drug deal. You know, it's not Miami. It's not L.A. You should be glad this is not a problem in Louisville. But that misunderstanding of sort of how these should be used and what quantities were ended up resulting in these absurdly small quantities.
But
I have to point out, Marty, it's the Justice Department's prosecutors who know what a big case is, who've insisted on using these as sort of their target and end up using these low-level numbers and overwhelm, you know, according to the data from the Sentencing Commission, you know, 61% of the crack cases are the lowest level offenders. Mm. 53% of the powder cocaine cases are the lowest level offenders. You know, street level dealers, couriers, lookouts, people who unload boats.
But are you saying it was innumeracy of the fact that members of Congress didn't know what a gram, what they didn't know how big a gram was, that that was part of what got baked into these laws?
Yes, because this, you know, this was, nobody was going to offer an amendment on the floor and say, you know, Mr. Speaker, the committee got it wrong. These numbers are wrong. Instead of 50 grams, we ought to have 200 kilograms. Mm. Nobody was going to offer that kind of amendment. Those were not going, you know, once these small quantities got included, they were going to be in there. In the haste of this thing, you know, the way the committee usually works is, you know, only members speak. And if I wanted to, if I had an idea, I'd write it on a slip of paper and pass it to the chairman. This thing was moving so fast, I raised my hand and asked to be recognized. And the chairman called on me and I said, we need to think about what the purity equivalents are, because right now we're talking about, you know, what could be 5 kilos that's mostly baking soda or some other adulterant and only a tiny amount of cocaine, and we could end up, you know, punishing people for the adulterants.
Hmm.
And, you know, a DEA person in the audience said, well, no, that would be a problem for DEA. Unfortunately, he didn't know that every sample already is being tested by the DEA lab for purity, you know, as soon as it's brought in. It's not a problem. It's routine procedure. But the Congress got misinformed on that point.
And is that where this discrepancy, that the crack cocaine versus the powdered cocaine discrepancy, is that where this came from?
No, it didn't come from that exactly. It did come from a broader failure to sort of think through how crack was made, where cocaine comes from, who wanted to talk to. It was haste. It was purely haste.
Hmm.
You know, these ideas were originated on Wednesday. They were adopted by the subcommittee on Thursday. They were ratified by the full committee on Friday to go to the floor. That was it. And they went to the floor, you know, right after the Labor Day recess in the House. Then the Senate took it. It worked its will back to the House, back and forth. And members are looking, you know, to campaign in the November election. And this thing was on the president's desk in October.
And you're saying the election, I guess, the control of Congress was at stake here?
The control of that's correct. The Senate had gone Republican in the 1980 election on Reagan's coattails. Reagan's not on the ballot in 86. The Democrats took the Senate back in 1986.
I'm looking at an interview you did at Salon, I guess it was a couple of years ago, and you describe, again, trying to work with members of Congress to try to figure out some of these laws, and you called, and I'm quoting here, a very respected narc named Johnny St. Valentine Brown, whose nickname was J-Ru. Tell us about him.
He was the most respected, famous narc in the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, who had been detailed to the Select Committee on Narcotics in the House. I collaborated closely with that committee. When the first proposal that I made to the subcommittee, that we use the DEA's high-level definition to define the highest level traffickers, was rejected, I then went to J-Ru St. Valentine Brown. I said, quickly, you know, tomorrow I've got to give the subcommittee some kind of definitions of high-level traffickers, and he gave me numbers, and that's the source. Brown, later it turned out, had repeatedly perjured himself in trials in D.C., misrepresenting his education and background, claiming that he was a graduate of Howard. This came out. He was so brazen at his sentencing for perjury, he submitted forged letters of recommendation from judges and other officials.
So the creation of these laws has led directly to the growth in the prison inmate population?
Absolutely. The federal prison population in 1986 was 36,000. As you said at the top of the hour, the population is now 219,000, and half of them there are on drug charges. You know, there are 25,000 federal drug cases being brought every year now, and most of these qualify because of their quantity for these mandatory minimums. And so people, you know, remember, before 1986, the basic drug offense was a 15-year maximum. So, you know, we're getting people now who routinely get 20, 30, and 40-year sentences. There's a guy named Clarence Aaron whose case I'm interested in. He was a college student in 1993. His cousins encouraged him to help him buy cocaine. He was a courier. He got paid $1,500. But he went to trial. He got three life sentences because of the quantity of cocaine that was involved under the sentencing guidelines. Three life sentences. He's still in prison.
Wow. Let me reintroduce you. And that's Eric Sterling talking about his years as counsel to the U.S. Judiciary Committee. This was from 79 to 89. He's now the president of the Criminal Justice Policy Center in Silver Spring, Maryland. We called him up to talk about Eric Holder's announcement on Monday at the American Bar Association, announcing a small change in the war on drugs, a directive to reduce the harsh sentences for many nonviolent drug-related crimes. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What's the thinking, though, in these mandatory minimum sentences was to create a kind of one-size-fits-all so that whoever appeared before a judge would get the same sentence and the judge would have less discretion to change sentences around?
The thinking actually wasn't very, very clear. You have to remember, in 1984, Congress enacted the Sentencing Reform Act, creating the Sentencing Commission to develop sentencing guidelines for all federal crimes. The Sentencing Commission was at work. This was very hastily done. You know, nobody sort of said carefully, what is the deterrent effect? What is a just sentence? How long should it be? These are numbers that are picked out of the air. Members of Congress are hardly as careful as you would wish in picking sentences. I'll give you an example. In the 94 crime bill, while it's being debated on the Senate floor, there were some serious fires that broke out in Malibu. And while it's still being shown on CNN, Senator Feinstein runs down to the Senate floor and offers an amendment to double the maximum penalty for arson because someone on TV said maybe this has been an arson. Mm-hmm. It hadn't even been proven to be an arson. No one had said, gee, the sentences for arson are too short. Nobody even knew what they were, but you know, she's going to say, let's double the sentences because we got a crime bill on the floor. I'm anti-arson. You know, there's a incoherence about the way in which sentencing gets done. You know, I could give you other examples as well.
Well, and I probably would like that, but what's so curious and I guess so troublesome is that these laws have had such a disproportionately negative effect on poor African American and poor Hispanic men. I mean, the idea was to treat people in a sense more equally, but we see who has in a sense paid the price for these laws.
The Sentencing Commission has been reporting for 20 years about the growing racial disparity in sentencing in federal law, and the Congress has resisted doing anything about it until 2010, in which they made the most trivial changes. They, at the smallest level, tinkered with the sentences for crack cocaine so that to get the 5-year mandatory minimum, instead of 5 grams, the government has to prove that there were 28 grams. Mm. And similar, you know, a slightly similar change in for the 10-year sentence. The whole effort is not being done at the highest levels. And my big critique against the Department of Justice and Eric Holder is, you know, that when Holder calls in San Francisco for sort of local guidelines, he's missing the point. You want to have a nationally directed Justice Department going after, in the drug cases, the Colombian cartels, the Mexican cartels, the killing organizations in Honduras and Guatemala, because those countries do not have the justice system capacity to do those cases. You do not need a DEA agent breaking down a door in South Philadelphia as part of a task force. You don't need DEA in Philadelphia helping to bring down the biggest crack dealers in Philadelphia because the Philadelphia police, the Pennsylvania State Police, they are perfectly competent to identify and prosecute them. The Philadelphia DA's office is a great DA's office. They know how to send drug dealers to prison. And Pennsylvania's got plenty of prison beds. But Philadelphia can't lock up Mexican drug lords. They can't lock up the Colombians. And so when you put around all 50 states, you spread the DEA workforce around, you know, West Virginia, Nebraska, and New Hampshire, and have them doing, you know, local crack dealers with, you know, small quantities, you're wasting the most precious law enforcement resources in the world on the lowest level offenders. It breaks my heart to see these low level offenders get kingpin sentences because U.S. attorneys have the opportunity to do it. They're politically ambitious and they're not being properly directed by the Attorney General.
But do you think the Attorney General and the Justice Department is sort of leading from behind? And by that, I mean, I think something like 27 states have been experimenting with prison reform, you know, instituting things like drug courts. Is the Justice Department following some of these states?
Yes, slowly, but I mean, not only are they following, I mean, you know, these issues have been repeatedly talked about by the U.S. Sentencing Commission, by private groups like the Sentencing Project, by Families Against Mandatory Minimums, by academics. You know, the stacks of law review articles and symposia and newspaper editorials and television exposés and radio commentary. This is an old issue. You know, Eric Holder was deputy attorney general in the Clinton administration for 3.5 years. He's been attorney general for more than 4 years. And finally, he's getting on board. It's out, you know, I mean, people are talking about, you know, he's going to be leaving the Justice Department, you know, in a few months. This is, you know, it's heartbreaking that this is coming in now. He had set up a sentencing task force at the beginning of the administration. They had a bunch of people come in and meet with top people in 2009 at the Justice Department to talk about what should be done. And it's taken them 4 years to see there's a problem.
Well, we have about a minute before our second break here. Then I do want to get some callers in on the conversation. But do you bear some either responsibility or even feel some sense of guilt because you did have a hand in writing some of these laws?
I certainly have responsibility. I did the best that I could to try to ameliorate it. I didn't have a vote. It wasn't my idea. It wasn't my policy. But, you know, when I meet the family members of people who are serving, you know, decades in prison, it breaks my heart. I know I have a responsibility. That's part of why I'm trying, you know, to help reform these laws.
And have you changed your view on drug laws? Just a quick response, and then we'll finish up after the short break.
I haven't changed my view. I've always felt that drug laws didn't make sense. But remember, I'm an attorney, and my job was to work for the members of Congress. I had a very important job. The chairman of the Subcommittee on Crime, Congressman Hughes from New Jersey, is a hero. He's smart, intelligent, hardworking, completely honest. I loved working for him. I had tremendous opportunities. We didn't have the votes.
That's Eric Sterling, our guest today on Radio Times, the president of the Criminal Justice Policy Center, talking about his years as a counsel to the U.S. House Judiciary Committee, 79 to 89, helping to write some of these Get Tough on Drug laws. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This week on This American Life, a journalist is given a phone number to call, and when she does...
Hello.
Turns out the people on the other end of the phone are a group of hostages being held and tortured in a desert thousands of miles away.
And then he told me about their situation, that they were 29 to begin with, but that one had died.
And then she tried to save them.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Just about everything we wear, eat, or consume is transported in huge containers on enormous ships. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Rose George about an invisible and sometimes exploitative part of the shipping world. And Grayson Schaefer tells us about the Sherpas on Mount Everest who risk injury or death helping people climb. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
A revealing portrait of modern-day journalists.
I found this amazing combination of The Odd Couple meets Woodward and Bernstein. These were the two people who broke this huge story.
Investigative reporter Peter Moss goes behind the scenes with the two reporters with whom NSA leaker Edward Snowden shared his secrets. Next time on The Takeaway from Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Eric Sterling. We're getting his opinion about Attorney General Eric Holder's announcement on Monday to reduce mandatory minimum sentences for non-violent drug crimes. This policy change intended to reduce overcrowding in federal prisons, save money, and reform some of the harsh laws which have ended up discriminating against African-American and Hispanic men when it comes to incarceration. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Erica, I'm curious about what you think should happen to those people who are currently in prison serving these long sentences that Eric Holder says are in a sense overcharging criminals.
The president has the power under the Constitution in Article 2, Section 2 to commute sentences. This is a power that's in the same sentence that says that he's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. It's an extremely important power. Unfortunately, Barack Obama has used this power less than any president. There is in the Department of Justice an office of the pardon attorney whose job is to provide information to the president about appropriate cases. There are thousands of people who have sought commutation of sentence or pardon. Unfortunately, the pardon attorney that they have kept has been criticized by the Inspector General for unprofessional conduct in misrepresenting to the Bush White House the facts of the Clarence Aaron case. But Eric Holder keeps that pardon attorney in the job. The Attorney General could set up review and expand that office and expedite the release of people who have already served 20-30 year sentences. There are people who, when these laws first were enacted, were still in prison, who got caught up in this. They can be released. They should be released. The president has the responsibility under the Constitution to do that. And I just, Marty, you did mention the racial disparity.
I did.
Yeah, and the Attorney General does not have in place any kind of mechanism to assure that there is no unwarranted racial disparity in the way the Department of Justice brings these cases. In the most recent data from the Sentencing Commission, in the crack cocaine area, the racial disparity between whites and blacks has gotten even worse than it was when they came into office in 2009. Now the disparity is 12.3-1. That is 12.3 blacks are going to federal prison on a crack cocaine charge for every one white person going on a crack case. This is outrageous. You know, if it's just outrageous.
Well, and Eric Holder also quoted a study finding that African-American men were disproportionately, and I'm scrambling here trying to find my little piece of paper. He seemed to reference some of these studies, but it's not, here it is. One deeply troubling report, this is Eric Holder, released in February, indicates that in recent years, black male offenders have received sentences nearly 20% longer than those imposed on white males convicted of similar crimes. This is just unacceptable. It is shameful. You're saying it's not enough to criticize that you want Eric Holder, and it sounds like President Obama, to take the next step.
Holder could certainly do it by issuing directives to the way U.S. attorneys' offices manage their cases, screen their cases, determine what cases to bring. Right now, it's very clear. The accepted practice is to bring low-level cases against African Americans. That's the accepted practice in the Department of Justice. And it's not being directly challenged through directives, orders, guidelines. The president certainly could begin releasing people who are there unjustly long, whether they're black or white, simply by having a well-run office of the pardon attorney.
Let me see. I'm sorry. No, go ahead. Finish your thought.
You said that, at the top of this, that these were small changes that the attorney general has proposed, and that's correct. It is important, there is important significance here that the administration is now for the first time more forthrightly discussing the problem. if there is follow-through, and I'm pessimistic there will be, but if there were follow-through, there would be big changes and it would be of tremendous significance. And there is a real opportunity for a bipartisan effort if the administration is forthright in working for it.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Robert from Clinton, New Jersey, joining us on Radio Times. And Robert, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. what Mr. Sterling is describing here is a law that was an exercise of the police power that was put into effect without any data to support it. Justice Roberts recently in the voting rights case struck down the formula for applying the Voting Rights Act because the data had been outdated and was no longer valid. Without data to support the exercise of the police power, the legislation passed is unconstitutional, and nobody is discussing that issue.
Well, Robert, thanks for raising it. Eric, do you want to weigh in on that?
I think Robert makes a very good point. Unfortunately, you know, as other justices have noticed, there's a drug exception to the Bill of Rights.
Meaning that if you are arrested or incarcerated for some drug-related crime, the Bill of Rights doesn't apply to you?
The same standards aren't scrupulously applied. The courts are results-oriented. The Roberts Court wanted to come up with this approach to the Voting Rights Act. It's less inclined to do so in drug cases. You know, the particular facts, you know, there have been challenges repeatedly to the unconstitutional application of this law. I testified in federal court in a case called Clary early on about sort of how hasty Congress was in doing this and what the factual background was. There certainly was a drug problem, and the Eighth Circuit found from my testimony that the recognition that there was a problem was sufficient without going into the kinds of details that Robert raised.
You know, I'm looking at some testimony you gave a couple of years ago. This was a Rethinking Federal Sentencing Policy and 25th Anniversary of the Sentencing Reform Act, sponsored by the Congressional Black Caucus and some other groups. And you said, for effective sentencing reform, we need new paradigms, new language, new arguments, and new allies in the thinking about drugs. We need a new political climate to do this. We have to stop characterizing drug users as losers, drug addicts as dangerous, and drug dealers as poisoners of youth. We have to stop talking about zero tolerance, abstinence only, and having a drug-free America. These slogans are not policies. They're not even meaningful goals, and they undermine the necessary political environment. That was back in 2009. Those words still work for you today?
They do, and I thank you very much for repeating them to your audience this morning.
Well, I mean, what you're really saying that we need to rethink the quote-unquote war on drugs.
We do. I've worked on drug abuse prevention and treatment issues for a very long time, and nobody knows who is at risk for becoming addicted to drugs or alcohol. These are not bad people who become addicted. They have either genetic problems, behavioral problems, untreated mental illness, untreated abuse, untreated trauma. We re-victimize so many people who've been victimized once as they suffer from drug abuse by putting them in prison and not having enough treatment. If we were spending on treatment what we spend on punishment, we would be, you know, a much better society, a much happier society, and the demand for drugs would be dramatically reduced.
I read that costs, these are federal, in federal prison, it costs about $30,000 a year to keep someone imprisoned in federal prison. Does those numbers make sense?
The last number I saw for, I think, fiscal year 2011 was about $26,000 as the average for a federal prisoner. That was from a congressional research study that was published in January 2013.
Let me see what Cassandra from Manassas, Virginia has to say. Cassandra, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm a college student. Oh, hi.
Hi.
Sorry. I'm a college student, and I was wondering if you have any tips for me to get involved and make a positive change towards sensible policy reform.
Go ahead,
well,
Eric.
Cassandra, you know, as a college student, I encourage you strongly to join the chapter of Students for Sensible Drug Policy that's on your campus. And if there isn't one, to start a chapter. You can go to the website schoolsnotprisons.org, and they have really a very, very well-written, clear, step-by-step guide how to start a chapter and all the kinds of things that you can do for sensible drug policy. You can encourage your college not to threaten to expel people who seek medical help when somebody's having an overdose. These are called public health Good Samaritan 911 approaches. Many states have passed laws so that if you know that someone's having a drug overdose and you call 911, you don't have to worry that the cops are going to come in and arrest you or arrest the patient as you're trying to get medical care. And this is, you know, an important way to save lives of students and others, both in the case of alcohol and drugs. And learn, of course, how to recognize somebody who is overdosing and learn what to do. You know, there's so many terrible myths that people have, you know, burn the fingers or toes or put people in ice water and instead of getting, you know, the proper medical care, you know, and making sure that the drug in naloxone is available, you know, to inject to reverse the effects of the overdose and save the life of the person. So, Cassandra, I think that would be my number one tip as a college student is to join Students for Sensible Drug Policy.
Cassandra, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Eric, what do you think about drug courts?
Drug courts are very, very useful. I've gone to numbers of drug court graduations. It's a very intense kind of probation. The two problems I have with drug courts is that they are presented as a kind of magical solution, but they can never be brought up to scale. If every judge in America spent all their time only managing a drug court, that still wouldn't be enough judicial supervision of the demand that the justice system presents. So it's the question of scale. You know, I've gone to a drug court graduation, you know, where five people have graduated. You know, the room is filled with, you know, all the judges of the court and the district attorney and the president of the Bar Association and so on. These people do get good treatment, but that's you know, it's not enough. The second problem can be that some drug courts, for example, say, well, we're not going to take repeat offenders or we won't take violent offenders, that the very people that you most want to treat get excluded in sort of ways that somebody says, well, this is too soft. You know, you want rehabilitation. You've got to figure out how do we change behavior. Change behavior of drug addicts, change behavior of people who are mentally ill, change the behavior of offenders. That's the measure of what you want to accomplish is changing behavior. And punishment does not change behavior. Warehousing does not change behavior.
Let me get to Bob from Cape May Courthouse to join us on Radio Times. Bob, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Sterling, this is a breath of fresh air just to hear it. Better late than never. My issue has always been the cost of incarceration versus education. You're spending so much more on incarcerating people that have a problem in the first place rather than at the other end. If you educate them from a young age, you probably won't see as many doing drugs. And it just gets me that we're draconian in our approach to drugs.
Well, Bob, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Eric, your thoughts or your response?
Education is, we're all in favor of education. It'll solve every problem, but not really. Highly educated people do become drug users and drug addicts. It's widespread across all classes and educational groups. So I don't think education is going to prevent drug use. I don't think there's anything that's going to prevent it. You know, the toothpaste is out of the tube. Hmm. Drugs work. People know about them. People like to get high. I think that the challenge is to manage drug use, manage drug addiction in our society. You manage it not through prisons, but through regulatory approaches in the marketplace and through social approaches of behavior. We need to establish real cultural controls about what's appropriate behavior. We see this with cigarette smoking. We've changed the American culture around cigarettes. We can change the culture in subcultures, I think, around drug use, but that only happens when drugs, I think, are legalized and you can use effective social controls instead of simply stigma and hiding.
Bob, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're almost out of time here, but I saw a piece that you wrote about Gerlachowski. Gerlachowski. I didn't even know how to say his name. He has been the drug czar, as you describe, unimaginative and often invisible.
I apologize for those remarks.
Do you?
I'm sorry that I said those remarks.
Why did you say them and why do you apologize?
I said them because I was so turned off by his views on marijuana and the stupid things that he said about legalization when he came in. When I read his strategies, I spent more time looking at the boilerplate bull rather than the innovative stuff that was snuck in. He has been trying to reach out in harm reduction, in clean needle exchange, in spread of naloxone. I've sent him a letter of apology. And I do apologize to him for my harsh words. I don't think he said anything intelligent about marijuana, and I allowed my misfocus on those remarks to blind me to the constructive things that he's done.
Well, I appreciate that honesty. I'm sure he did as well. Eric Sterling, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Marty, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. President of the nonprofit Criminal Justice Policy Foundation that's located in Silver Spring, Maryland. He was also counsel to the U.S. House Judiciary Committee, principally responsible for a lot of this anti-drug legislation that we were talking about from 79 to 89. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, archives, podcasts, Sirius Satellite Radio. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And stay with us. We'll be right back.